It was really a response in anger, in frustration, and outbreak at that kind of cynical, secret deals that leaders would engage in.
Tune in to Copenhagen Daily every day from 11 a.m. till noon throughout the UN Climate Conference on Resonance 104.4 FM and online at resonancefm.com. Welcome to Copenhagen Daily on the fourth day of the UN Climate Talks in Copenhagen. We have an extended feature today on the African response to the so-called Danish text, the leaked draft agreement for the Copenhagen deal that the US, UK and Denmark were planning to spring on the poor majority world in the final hours of the conference when it closes at the end of next week. But first, President Obama picks up his Nobel Peace Prize today, partly for having re-engaged in the UN Climate Talks. The sad irony is that the Obama administration is currently dragging the talks away from a legally binding international treaty and has put inadequate cuts and negligible finance on the table. Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman put the following question to Nimmo Bassi, chair of Friends of the Earth International.
Nimmo Bassi, what do you want to happen out of here when you have world leaders like our own President Obama saying there will not be a binding agreement coming out of COP15, the summit?
It's really shocking that Obama would say a thing like that before even coming down here. It's like telling us that we've come here to waste our time. That kind of statement means to me that we have a lot of time to play around with politics of climate change. But indeed, the world has no time. We've run out of time. We're not even in injury time. We've gone to the brink, and the President of the United States, Obama, has a responsibility to take this matter seriously. It's an issue of justice. It's completely unethical to play politics or play under the table to make some private secret deals among presidents about climate change. That is totally unacceptable.
The good news is that the Obama administration already has the power to regulate coal-fired power plants, potentially phasing them out on a timeline compatible with the science. A couple of days ago, the Environmental Protection Agency in the US announced its intention to move forward with such regulation. Here's Amy Goodman again.
The Obama administration's moved a step closer to regulating greenhouse gases. On Monday, the Environmental Protection Agency said six gases, including carbon dioxide and methane, endanger the environment and public health. The move would allow the EPA to take action against greenhouse gases without needing congressional approval. EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson made the announcement Monday at a news conference in Washington.
Today's action is a step towards enduring pragmatic solutions to the enormous challenge of climate change. It is a step towards innovation, investment, and implementation of technologies that reduce harmful emissions.
At a side event here on Tuesday at the UN conference in Copenhagen, the Center for Biological Diversity launched a new report entitled, Yes, He Can, President Obama's power to make an international climate commitment without waiting for Congress. We showed that Obama does not need to wait for Congress before taking strong action to reduce US emissions. The report draws on the work of a number of legal scholars and decisions of the Supreme Court. The Center for Biological Diversity, along with 350.org, have been petitioning the EPA to regulate coal-fired power plants in a way that corresponds to the latest science on climate change. The world waits for Obama to bring an ambitious target to the table using his existing authority. The CBD have shown that the US has no excuses for lame domestic targets, and that contrary to popular belief, he is not constrained by the difficulty of getting legislation through Congress. Now to our African story. The disclosure of the secret so-called Danish text has caused upset amongst developing countries. But African representatives inside the conference have responded most vocally in demonstrations. Frederica Whitehead filed this report for Copenhagen Daily.
Yesterday, we broadcast some rough and ready audio in which you heard the sound of the Pan-African Climate Justice Alliance demonstrating during the climate talks here in Copenhagen. The recording you have just heard was provided by 350.org, who were present during the action. One of the key problems for Africa is the 2-degree global cap. A global warming, an average global warming of 2 degrees, would mean that, in fact, temperatures in Africa would rise by 3.5 degrees. This, in effect, would make large parts of Africa uninhabitable. The target of attempting to limit global temperatures to a 2-degree rise is now 13 years old, and scientists are now telling us that serious damage will happen well before a 2-degree rise in average temperatures. And many people are arguing for the upper threshold to be reduced to a 1.5 degree rise or even a 1 degree temperature rise. In the recording, you heard the impromptu demonstration led by Lumumba Diaping, one of the Sudanese negotiators here in Copenhagen. Diaping was reacting furiously at the news that broke of a leaked document now known as the Danish Accord. You heard him leading the chart, "No political deal, political deal, bad deal. Nothing more than one degree. One degree, one Africa, one position. He's reacting against a divide and rule strategy that was revealed by the leaking of the Danish Accord. This was leaked to The Guardian, and you can read the full text on the website. Basically, the Danish Accord was a pre-prepared document which completely goes against the spirit of negotiations. Something that was pre-prepared and given to weaker, smaller countries to sign with some financial incentives, which you'll hear discussed in broadcasts which we're about to put on. In a little while, we will broadcast excerpts from a press conference that gives the G77 reaction to this leaked document. It was an incendiary event, and this has been the talk of the conference. Firstly, I'm going to go over and talk to Landry Natretsi from 350degrees.org. Could you tell me what happened in that meeting?
Yesterday night, the evening, there was a meeting of the civil society organization present in the COP15, and Ambassador Lumumba, who is the chief negotiator on the G77 group, came to give us a briefing of how the negotiations are making progress. So she came up with a news that an information which said that the Danish and other countries like South Africa, India, Brazil are trying to push for an agreement that states that an increase of 2 degrees Celsius maybe could be something that view as an agreement after COP15. All the audience was shocked by this information. But if 2 degrees Celsius means for Africa 3.5 degrees Celsius of increasing of our temperature, which is the equivalent to the death or the suicide for the African continent. So just after this, it was really an emotional moment. The Ambassador Lumumba, which is a very respected person, even cried when telling about this. Cried about to see how he's seeing the delegates from different countries consider this this target, this text which is being now pushed as something which can be as a compromise as a text, while we know that 2 degrees Celsius of increasing of temperature is a synonym of death for all Africa countries, which are the most affected countries by climate change. This is why after we organized protestation outside to say that we never support, and instead of having such agreement, better let be no agreement instead of having such agreement.
So it's been suggested that South African delegates have been pressured and asked to side against the rest of Africa and sign this deal, which would accept a 2 degree rising global warming, so a 3.5 degree Celsius increase in temperatures in Africa.
Yes.
Do you know whether that's true or...?
I can't tell that it is true or not.
It's a rumour.
We have rumours. I say rumours that South Africa and another one big country in Africa are supporting this deal which is being pushed now. There are only two countries in Africa which are still supporting this position, and this is what I can say about this. Now there are different meetings and try to see involving parliamentarians and other civil society activists to try to convince South Africa delegation and the delegation of the other country in order to get them back to the same African position, which is turned now to 1.5. It is not even a very big deal or very safe deal for us, but better be 1.5 instead of 2 degrees Celsius. Yes.
Okay. If South Africa had or did agree to sign the Danish text, what impact would that have on the African bloc?
If South Africa remained with its current position and is still supporting the two degree Celsius rise in temperature, I think the African group will have to take strong measures and will protest by all means possible against this position. This may involve the walkout meeting, because you know, maybe when you have never traveled in Africa or see the impact of climate change on rural population, which are the most poor, without resources, which are struggling every day to try to resist and to adapt themselves in the way they can to impact of climate change. And now South Africa, due to some economical interest, is still supporting this position, this agreement, which is, in when we analyze better and look through, is only a better deal for rich countries, yeah. But the worst one we can have for poor countries. This is really a sad situation. This is what I called selfishness and only looking for their own interest instead of considering the whole interest of Africa. Dear delegates, remember you are representing those who elected you. If anything else, if they do anything contrary to this, they will be responsible forever for what will happen in the future.
I'm speaking to Landry Nintaseri, who is the Burundian coordinator for 350.org.
Thank you.
Phil England put the same question to Nemo Bassi, who is the chairman of Friends of the Earth International and the executive director of Friends of the Earth Nigeria.
And we are really, really disappointed that these governments could sit down behind the back of the rest of the international community to concoct some kind of political deals that are wishy-washy, that don't recognize the urgency of the climate challenge, that doesn't recognize that we are at the brink of a major, major crisis, more than what we've ever experienced, that governments could sit down and prepare that kind of document that doesn't, even before negotiations started, it's a big slap in the face of the world, and it makes nonsense of us coming here to talk under the United Nations process. This is a way of disuniting the nations, driving a wedge between nations, dividing to rule. It's colonial, it's unacceptable, and it's actually very embarrassing.
I understand there's some link between the demonstration that occurred yesterday in the main auditorium. It wasn't exactly clear at the time what that was about. I understand there's some link between the Copenhagen Accords and that demonstration?
Yes, the so-called Copenhagen Accords, you know, was one of the factors in what triggered of the spontaneous protest by civil society groups from Africa yesterday. And you know, it was a realization that we could all be here just to waste 2 weeks without coming out with any concrete outcome that would be legally binding, that would make nations cut emissions, especially industrialized nations, cut emissions as source to such a degree that would present a possibility of global warming being slowed down and Africa really surviving. So people were, it was really a response in anger, in frustration, and outrage at that kind of cynical secret deals that leaders would engage in. Yeah, so that's what happened yesterday.
That was Phil England talking to Nemo Bassi, Executive Director of Friends of the Earth Nigeria. This next recording is the official press briefing of the day from the G77 bloc, and the speaker is Lumumba Diaping. Diaping is the chief negotiator for the G77 bloc. He's a Sudanese delegate, and he has been outspoken in his criticism of the Danish president following the leaked Danish accord. In the following speech, he insists that Barack Obama steps up to the plate.
What I want to communicate and convey to you is that this text, the Danish text, is an extremely dangerous document for developing countries. It is a total violation of the principles of transparency and openness. It is a rejection of the fact that the UNFCCC is the only legitimate forum for conducting negotiations by parties to the convention. And in terms of substance, it is a fundamental rejection and reworking of the UNFCCC balance of obligations between developing and developed countries. Not only that, it's our humble view, it's equally an insult to the elected president of COP15. This text comes from the office of the Prime Minister of Denmark. Its overreaching strategic goal is to destroy the balance of obligations between developing and developed industrialized Western countries. And this is done by and with a zealous rejection of the notion of common but differentiated responsibilities and respective capabilities. And further, it denies the fact that developed countries have a historical responsibility for damaging the atmospheric space, which is something started and has been continuing for the last over the last 200 years. The text then pushed further and demand a renegotiation and negotiations of a new treaty instrument that will amend the UNFCCC and then kills off the Kyoto Protocol. And this is done by very careful maneuvering and merging the LCA and the KP tracks. So a historical or a historic political agreement is a disguised decision to reopen and renegotiate both the convention and the Kyoto Protocol. How is this done? It is done by creating a new fiction of dividing developing countries to vulnerable and culpable. So it is the usual divide and rule. The vulnerable states then are offered through the text and through the circle of commitments and are enticed with the notion of fast-track financing. But embedded and wrapped in this fast track is a coup, a Bretton Woods takeover of the UNFCCC. And of course, this is all aimed at preserving and advancing developed countries' economic dominance and supremacy. That, of course, is not news for you, nor for us. One would say that the empire has been doing that since 16th century. The empire has always relentlessly and ruthlessly grabbed natural resources. The new global resource is the atmospheric space. It is the carbon space. The Danish texts, and let me say texts, seek to secure 60% of the global atmospheric space to 20% of the world's wealthiest nations. It is a crumble and a rush of extraordinary magnitude. The fundamental right of developing countries to economic development are thus impaired. And those of us who will survive, if ever they succeed in doing that, will have to continue begging. There are two other important elements and dimensions to this Danish text. The first one is the issue of the circle of commitments, which includes many heads of states and the Secretary General of the United Nations. And the second one is the United States of America. It is our humble view that the Secretary General, as the chief and the highest international civil servant, need to reflect deeply on his role on climate change. His role as a non-party should, ought to, and must be that of a good shepherd and an honest broker. He should not be seen as wedded to advancing the interests of one global power bloc against the fundamental rights, the economic rights of developing countries, the poor, and all humanity. The deal he should be associated with must be a just and an equitable deal, a deal that safeguards the world, a deal that aims at achieving radical reductions of emissions by developed countries and rapid economic development and industrialization for developing countries. It has to be a deal that brings about a global green economic revolution in the interest of all. A deal that would lead to harmony between humanity and nature, not one that is simply preserving the status quo. The United Nations' main goal is to help facilitate cooperation between the nations and countries of the world. As for the United States, we want to convey the following message to the people of the United States and President Obama. The world cannot achieve an equitable and a just deal that would save Africa and small island states and many others without the participation of your country, without the participation of the United States. Your country should join the Kyoto Protocol. Global peace and security is not served by isolationism and exceptionalism. Your country should commit to an ambitious goal for 2050 in a holistic manner, including years of 2017, 2020, 2030, and 2050. And this is because the United States is the world's largest historical and per capita emitter of greenhouse gases. The United States' offer of a 4% reduction of emissions would not help save Africa and many developing countries, as I have mentioned. We equally understand that the strategic gist of the Danish text, which President Obama's team is pushing for. And we understand that the president himself will help persuade the leaders of developing countries to sign. Is an unfair and inequitable deal. And we humbly ask of President Obama that the new dawn of multilateralism that he promised the world should not be simple business as usual. The West prevails at the expense of the rest of developing countries.
Now
That was Khalifa Ould Aid and Dimmy Mint Abba and a piece called Hassania Song for Dancing from Moorish Music of Mauritania on World Circuit Records from 1990. And before that you heard Frederica Whitehead's package on the African response to the so-called Danish text here at the UN Climate Conference in Copenhagen. Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! Asked Martin Kaur of the South Centre and author and journalist Naomi Klein to explain why developing countries are so upset by this leaked draft agreement.
I think we all have been told that there is no plan B for Copenhagen and that we have to work very hard, you know, on the documents on the table. So the fact that we have this 10-page document shows that they have been working on a plan B. And most of the developing countries that I have spoken to do not know at all about this text. So they feel shortchanged in that they had no say, they were not invited to contribute to a text that may be parachuted down on them later on this week by the ministers or by the presidents, and they would not have had enough time to look at it. So the process is what is bothering many, but also the substance, because the text calls for a 50% cut in global emissions by 2050. And it says that the developed countries are willing to cut by 80%. So my calculations show that if this is being proposed, the developing countries would have to cut their emissions by at least 60% per capita, or about the same as the developed countries. And that will bring their per capita emissions of greenhouse gases to about 2 tons per person by 2050. Whereas a country like the United States, which now has 20 tons per capita, would go down to about 4 tons. So this means that the U.S. would still be able to have double the per capita emissions that poor developing countries have in 2050, when the United States is so superior in terms of income, in technology, and they have contributed so much, you know, to the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So this is what is outraging the developing countries.
And Martin, what do you think developing countries are going to do? Do you suspect that there'll be a walkout? What is the next step?
I don't think there will be a walkout, but they would now, I think, in fact, they should now come out with their own text, you know, to say that this is our position on what we see as the Copenhagen decision and not something that somebody else is putting for us. I think the other major issue for the developing countries is that this text implies the closure of the Kyoto Protocol. And that's something that all the developing countries are united against, because the Kyoto Protocol is the legally binding international agreement. The only country not in it is the United States.
Naomi Klein, let's go on from what Martin Kaur is saying. The issue of the Kyoto Protocol in the United States is always talking about it sunsets, it ends in 2012. Mm-hmm. But that's not true.
It's one of the great misconceptions, and I actually didn't fully understand it until Martin explained it to me. So he probably can explain it much better than I can. But there is no expiration date on the Kyoto Protocol. What it had was a first period of emissions cuts that ends in 2012. And the idea was that countries would come back together and increase their emission cuts and develop the agreement. But the idea that it just needs to be scrapped completely and replaced with a wholly new New Deal, and that in addition to this, there isn't time to come up with a whole New Deal, which is the position of the U.S. negotiators here, is based on this faulty premise that the Kyoto Protocol expires. But I think, you know, the real issue here is what they want to replace the Kyoto Protocol with is much weaker than the Kyoto Protocol. They want to, the Kyoto Protocol comes up with a goal for all the countries that they have to reach in terms of emissions cuts, and it's legally binding. Here, what they want to replace it to is all countries go off, come up with their own goals, and then it's sort of mashed together into an agreement that really isn't a multilateral agreement, because the whole idea of multilateralism is that countries agree on the same set of rules, and they agree to a common monitoring mechanism. So the great irony of what's happening here in Copenhagen is that it takes place in this context of this huge global celebration of the U.S. re-embrace of multilateralism. In fact, Obama is getting the Nobel Prize specifically for this. In the citation for the Nobel Prize, they talk about the re-engagement with the climate talks, the embrace of multilateralism. He's getting the Nobel Prize for it, but what's actually happening here is that they're using the tools of multilateralism, the infrastructure of multilateralism, to destroy multilateralism, to kill multilateralism.
Meanwhile, things are stirring in Nigeria. I spoke to Nimo Bassi, chair of Friends of the Earth International, about Nigerian civil society's new commitment to keeping their oil in the soil. So I'm here with Nimo Bassi, who's the chair of Friends of the Earth International and executive director of Friends of the Earth Nigeria. The first question I wanted to ask was about the conference that was held recently in Nigeria, which sounded historic as far as I could tell. Could you say something about that?
Yeah, we had a conference in Nigeria focusing on post-petroleum Nigeria. As you know, Nigeria depends so much on crude oil for revenue. More than 85% of national revenue, foreign exchange earnings, come from sales of crude oil. And because of the dependence on this resource, other aspects of the economy, other things have been neglected and left to rot away. Everything, infrastructure and even immaterial things like political system, have been impacted by crude oil in Nigeria. But above all, we made a major demand on the government to stop looking for new oil. We're asking that new oil be left in the soil. And, you know, we found that government would always say, well, oil is what gives us revenue, so we leave oil in the soil, what are we going to do? But we are very conservative in our demand. We're asking that you can keep on extracting from the wells that are producing now, but don't open up new wells. Don't even look for new wells. Don't give out new oil blocks. And doing this would not mean a loss of revenue, and I tell you why. Number one, from official sources we're hearing, something that's alarming to us more than what we suspected, that as much crude oil as is being officially exported is also being illegally taken. Oil theft is at a massive scale. It is said to involve oil corporations, to involve international syndicates. It's not a secret. It's something that is really raging in the oil fields. And perhaps it's part also contribution to the violence. So we're asking leave new oil in the soil, but stop oil theft. That immediately makes whatever estimates of oil reserve Nigeria has to become more reliable. Because right now, if you think you have a certain amount of oil in reserve and then so much is not accounted for, then the reserve figures are neither here nor there.
And who is involved with this? I understand it's quite a high level. Is it the Environment Ministry? Pretty much the whole of Nigerian civil society?
Yes, we had, at the end of the day, the resolutions of the conference was endorsed by 117 organizations, and the conference was supported by the Federal Ministry of Environment and the UNDP, as well as Friends of the Earth, Netherlands, and Oxfam Novib. The outcomes are not driven by those who supported the conference, but the civil society groups who were there, 117, fully endorsed what we did and what the outcome was. And you see, by leaving new oil in the soil, you're stopping the release of carbon as source. It's a major move to help check global warming. And we're saying that not only crude oil should be left in the soil, we should also not look for any other form of dirty energy. Leave the coal in the hole. Don't look for the tar sand, because this brings even worse environmental consequences.
It seems to represent a gear change or a paradigm shift almost in civil society's view on this, because up until recently it was much more about limiting local pollution, oil spills, local environmental damage, maybe getting a bit more tax revenues for development in the Niger Delta, things like that. But this is now a different demand. It's about saying that actually this stuff is probably not so good for us after all.
Yeah, what we're doing is a major political and environmental demand. We want to be a real shift in the political thinking, and we want the Nigerian economy to be re-engineered, kick back to start, come back alive. The economy has been dead. People are living outside the formal economy. People are just surviving on their own. So, and there's been a complete disconnect between public revenue and people's prosperity. And we're saying when you leave new oil in the soil and recover a lot of oil from oil theft, whatever shortfall, people would contribute by paying for barrels of oil when you leave in the soil. You know, people are poor, they cannot pay, but they would try. There are people indicating that if they have a responsible government and system that would manage the economy properly, they are ready to make sacrifices. People want to say, yes, this is our money in the national purse. It's our money that's being spent. Spend our money right. Be accountable, be transparent. But, you know, when people just stay back and then oil revenues flood the national coffers and you have huge budgets and then nothing impacts the people. Since oil economy is almost like a fiction, I mean, it's like voodoo economics. People are so disconnected from the resources, and a lot of decision makers don't even see the pollution. So there's no concern. So we want to restore a connection between governance and those who are governed.
More upsets at the UN climate conference yesterday when Tuvalu confronted rich countries over whether or not they would be supporting a legally binding outcome. Here's how Greenpeace USA blogged on the incident.
So a couple of hours ago, the plenary session was suspended because the Tuvalu representatives raised questions about whether there would be a legally binding agreement at the end of the conference. Now, a group of industrialized countries stayed silent on the issue and didn't say a thing. So the president of COP15 meeting suspended discussions, and they're just about to restart now. So we've got a load of activists down to the scene to show support for Tuvalu negotiators. To be honest, it's incredible that in such a short space of time, hundreds of people have got down here from all over the conference to show this amazing show of solidarity.
In recognition of the fact that the European Union has, in reality, a maximum 15% cut on the table at these climate change talks, when you factor in all the offsets, youth from the Friends of the Earth lined the corridor of the conference centre with placards asking for Europe to commit to a 40% cut by 2020 without offsets. Over the next couple of days, European heads of state will be meeting in Brussels in what is their last chance to save the climate talks by finally putting deep cuts and serious money on the table. We end today's show with a blog from Paul Connor, one of five people who have been fasting for over 30 days and have pledged to continue until at least the end of the climate talks. Here he is on day 16 of his fast, talking about what he sees as the importance of civil disobedience in pushing climate change action up the political agenda. Next week, here in Copenhagen, there will certainly be plenty of that. Do join us again tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
Hi, everybody. This is Paul from Climate Justice Fast on day 16. I wanted to make a vlog today to say thank you to everybody that has written messages of support on our website. It means a lot to us. And I wanted to read out one in particular because it's about something I want to talk about. It's from David Stark in Berkeley, California. And he says, I will commit civil disobedience for the first time in my life, November 20. So David, thank you for that. And thank you for, I guess, the feeling that we've helped you come to that decision and take that action, because at the moment, civil disobedience is becoming an incredibly important thing for people around the world to do. So what is civil disobedience? Civil disobedience is when you break a law, basically. And you break a law because you feel that it's an unjust law. And you feel you have a moral duty that goes beyond the laws of your nation to try to change that law and to break it and to stand up for what you think is right. And it's becoming incredibly important right now because our laws and our system, almost everywhere in the world, is set up in a way to allow people to pollute the atmosphere to the point where we get runaway climate change and we cause enormous suffering. So basically the system itself, you know, these laws themselves are unjust. They're unjust to, you know, future generations and obviously the poorest people in the world who are suffering the effects of climate change right now. So they need to be changed, and civil disobedience is becoming incredibly important because at the moment our leaders, as we know, are moving too slowly to stop climate change. So it is up to us, the people, to put our bodies on the line and to risk arrest and to embrace arrest and even imprisonment to make sure that we don't past the tipping point and that we don't get runaway climate change and that future generations and our children are protected. So basically, how do you get involved in civil disobedience? It's not that easy, you know. For people perhaps like David or like myself a year ago, we wouldn't have really had any idea how or why to do civil disobedience. So really, what I would recommend and really plead with people to do, if they think they're ready to take that step, which I hope many of us are, and I know many of us are, just get in touch with the people in your area that are experienced with civil disobedience. And you can find them in the US. The Yes Men have a great website that you can sign up for. There's Greenpeace, there's Friends of the Earth, there's Rising Tide. And there's all sorts of groups, actually. All you really have to do is do a search for climate action and then wherever you live. And it might not be the first people you encounter, but after you'll encounter them and then you'll encounter the people who will, you know, be able to help you to take that step, because we need bodies, basically. We need foot soldiers, you know, in the fight against climate change. And really, getting arrested once or twice, you know, it's not going to ruin your career, you know. It's climate change, on the other hand, will probably ruin your career if we don't stop it. You know, there's how many baby boomers, you know, speak with pride about being arrested for protesting the Vietnam War? You know, it's not something to be ashamed of. It's a badge of honor, you know, and it's something that honorable people have done all throughout history. Civil disobedience got women the vote. Civil disobedience got black people equal rights. You know, civil disobedience has, freed India, you know. So we need more people to take that step and to stand up and let our leaders know that if they're not going to take the steps that are necessary to stop runaway climate change, well, you know, we're going to make it happen anyway, you know. And you know, civil disobedience might not be able to get us there alone. However, it can force the issue. You know, if it becomes literally you know, twice as expensive to build new coal-fired power plants, because you're constantly having to battle off protesters and people who are willing to get arrested and put themselves on the line, then, you know, it's going to help make the shift away from fossil fuels into renewables. And that's just what we need. So, so David, I salute you, and I hope that our action has helped you get the inspiration and the courage to do that, and I hope that it does for others too. So that's my spiel for this evening. See you soon.
Copenhagen Daily, every day from 11 a.m. till noon, throughout the UN Climate Conference on Resonance 104.4 FM and online at resonancefm.com.
Oh, darling, it's gone past midnight, and won't you do me justice now?
Okay, honey, will you come along now?
Also cool. Hold me closer and put out the light, and then give me justice. Oh, darling, be you. I said, give me justice now. No brand or whiskey can do it right. No number of blankets can keep me warm. So hold me closer and put out the light, and then do me justice. Oh, darling, make it. Oh, yes, no more time to wait now. Tell me sweet stories. Tell me that you love me, honey. Oh, yeah, do me justice, yeah. Rock me slowly while you scratch my head, and then kiss me tenderly.